This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin, and you'll never be able to guess how many phone calls we received over last week's program.
How many people called in?
Ooh, you'll never guess.
More than 10?
You'll never guess.
Okay, I give up. How many people called in?
See? I told you you'd never guess.
You're right. I couldn't guess. So how many?
A whole big bunch.
How many is a whole big bunch?
Well, lots and lots.
Bob!
Some.
Bob, cut out the funny business. I asked our executive director, May Tran, and she told me how many phone calls we received.
Exactly how many calls?
Yes, she did.
She didn't tell me.
Well, she did tell me.
Well, I wouldn't believe her.
And why shouldn't we believe our executive director?
Well, because she'd always like Richard best.
Okay. How many people do you think called in after last week's show?
At least one.
And who was that?
Well, someone with a very important question.
Who was it?
Me.
If you had a question, why not just ask me?
Because Dr. Bill I trust. You? I'm not so sure about.
Bob, he is Dr. Bill.
Really? I imagined that he looked different.
Oh, this is radio. You sat right next to him when we recorded the show. What did you...
Richard. There. Cue me in.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
All right, Bob. This is Dr. Bill. What's on your mind?
Oh, that's better. See how different he looks? Well, I wanted to know more about Dr. Jacob Bulletin. His story is amazing. What can you tell me, Dr. Bill?
His story is amazing, but even more so given his perseverance. His story is told in a biography written by Rosalind Perlman and is entitled The Blind Doctor. Her insights into Dr. Bulletin are very personal. Her husband was the nephew of Dr. Bulletin's wife and lived with the Bulletins for some time.
He must have had a lot of help when he was growing up.
Only from his family. He was born in Chicago in 1888. His parents were poor immigrants. Now, imagine a time before talking computers or Braille note-takers, a time before we had programs to teach people to cane travel, or tape recorders, or Perkins Braillers, or talking books.
Well, how did he manage?
Pretty well, I think. Help me out here, Richard.
Glad to, Dr. Bill. His is a story where, literally, he did it on his own. At age 14, Jacob was valedictorian of his class. Following graduation, he improvised cane traveling techniques and traveled the network of streetcars in Chicago selling brushes and then typewriters. At age 16, the president of the company commended him on being one of the best typewriter salesmen that the company had. Next, he set his sights on becoming a doctor, but medical training did not come easy. He had to fight his way into medical school. But when he finished in 1912, he graduated with honors.
Ah, now a doctor.
Not yet. After graduation, he had to fight again. This time it was the red tape in order to take the exam to become licensed.
But when he finally succeeded, he became the first congenitally born blind person to attend medical school and to become a licensed physician in the United States.
And one of the things that led to his success was that along the way, he developed a set of three-dimensional models of the body's complex systems.
He kind of taught himself?
Well, not exactly. But he couldn't rely on someone else's pictures to tell him what went on inside the human body.
What happened next?
Later, he interned at Francis Willard Hospital in Illinois. While there, he diagnosed a serious heart ailment in a young woman who had been misdiagnosed by three other doctors. They thought it was psychological. After his internship, he worked for months as a volunteer physician in a facility for tuberculosis patients. Even though other doctors were constantly asking his opinion on cases, they would not hire him.
Why not?
They constantly cited his blindness.
I bet that was just an excuse for not paying him.
It was so suggested in his biography. But even this difficulty he overcame, and eventually he became a renowned heart and lung specialist in Chicago. He died there in 1924 at the young age of 36.
Wow. Now that is remarkable.
I'd like to respond to that with Dr. Bulletin's own words. He said, "Well, is there anything so remarkable about it? Because a man has no eyes, is it any sign that he hasn't any brains? That is the trouble with the world and the blind man. All the blind man asks is fair play. Give him an equal chance without prejudice, and he generally manages to hold his own with his more fortunate colleagues."
Not much has changed since Dr. Bulletin, has it?
Well, let's just say that we have a way to go yet.
I'd like to add something to that story. In those years between his graduation in 1912 and his death in 1924, Jacob Bulletin also organized the first troop of blind Boy Scouts and was their scoutmaster. He also was a member of the local Kiwanis Club, became a trustee, and eventually Lieutenant Governor Jr. of the Illinois Eastern District. That is, in addition to being a leading heart and lung specialist.
And I get tired just getting up in the morning.
What is so tiring about getting up?
I can't find my shoes.
I don't have that trouble finding my shoes.
Yeah, that's because you don't have to look for them.
That's true. Mine are always right where I left them.
Speaking of doctors and blindness, we came across a couple of interesting situations that we might use in place of an interview this week. The first is a study by a professor in the Department of Special Education Studies at a university in Lithuania. A Dr. Gudonis looked into fiction writing as an influence on the formation or reinforcement of social stereotypes about the blind.
Right. In 1989, he surveyed the opinions of 263 mainstream secondary school graduates. One questionnaire he used was called, quote, "The Blind Among the Sighted," end quote. 135 of those asked responded that their main source of information about the blind was fiction.
I take that to mean that those persons had no actual experience in dealing with someone who was blind.
I'd think so. He quotes from one source, an author named Korolenko, who said, "The blind is a condemned person who cannot see light and never will be able to. His life is darkness." Also, he said, "It is the most unhappy person to whom all the world seems black."
That attitude could also be seen in the illustrations in Korolenko's writings. One picture showed a blind man against a black background. This projects blindness in a very primitive way, and at the same time reinforces the feeling of a darkness that constantly crushes him.
The story went on to say that the attitude of society was most important in the ability of the blind to realize their potential. Some writers had suggested that talented blind people created a positive attitude about blindness, but the study disagreed. The society's attitude depended not so much on talented individuals as upon the level of democracy and humanism existent at different historical times.
Right. The study started by compiling a list of 212 famous blind people living at different times and in different countries. Then they divided them by professions. 77 were musicians who played organ, piano, or violin. Some were composers, some singers, and some were professors of music.
From that, we can assume that music was the most easily accessible profession for the blind, possibly influenced by the belief that blind people have a natural talent for music. Notice, though, the study didn't mention piano tuners.
So noted. After the musicians, 42 people were writers, 17 became teachers, and the rest found other professions.
Then the study looked at the time periods involved. From ancient times, only two names reach us. Homer, who composed the Iliad and the Odyssey in the 8th century BCE in Greece. And there was a Roman, Appius Claudius Sec, from the 4th century BCE. What's further of interest about Homer is that he didn't actually write those two epics on paper. He recited them from memory.
And I have trouble remembering my own phone number.
And you can look at it.
apparently not long enough.
And Appius was famous because it was under his leadership that the infrastructure of ancient Rome was built, including the city's urban water supply, which is still working.
During the Middle Ages, ancient culture was ignored, human dignity was constantly humiliated, and man's weaknesses, both physically and religiously, were emphasized. Under such circumstances, all creativity was stifled. Needless to say, very little was done to help the handicapped.
It wasn't until the Renaissance that a new era of cultural and ideological development began, with Dante in literature, Giotto in painting and sculpture. Based on ideas of humanism, the Renaissance stimulated the development of new ideas, while the rise of the progressive bourgeois class against feudalism created the changes necessary for conditions for the blind in society to improve. Individualism and human dignity were on the rise, with impetus being given by writers such as Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu, and Diderot.
The conclusions of that study were that once in a while, if a blind person became noted, it was considered a miracle. But that miracle did nothing to change opinion about others who were blind. Only when there were basic democratic humanistic values pushing the society were there real opportunities for the development of the talents of the blind.
That sounds like a willingness to find out how much better the sight impaired can be compared with what we might expect.
Does that mean it's right over there?
I don't think so.
Me neither. What else about doctors and blindness?
The work of Dr. Mark Strax. He is a member of the board of directors of the National Federation of the Blind of Pennsylvania, and he is also a medical doctor and prominent psychiatrist in Pennsylvania. In a speech at the National Federation of the Blind Convention, he asks, why are so many people afraid to give sight-impaired people a chance, especially in jobs?
Did he have an answer?
I think he did. He said, I think you already have the answer in the question. Fear. He said that in his early years, he sensed that the kids his own age felt he was different. They acted as if he were different, and they certainly treated him as if he were different. To get through medical school, he had the backing of his parents, but precious little other support. Sheer determination got him through.
That sounds just like Dr. Bulletin.
He told a story to try to explain people's attitudes. The story was of a homeless man that one night crawled into a railroad car for refuge. Once inside, he tried to close the door. As the door closed, it suddenly locked. Only then did he realize that the car he had locked himself into was a refrigeration car, and he had no way out. He might have yelled, he might have pleaded, and maybe he prayed. All that is certain is that he was able to write down his last thoughts. He spoke of getting colder and colder, and of finding it harder and harder to breathe. His words trailed off before he lost consciousness.
The next morning, a crew unlocked the door and found the man. He was dead. But why? The refrigeration unit was broken. It wasn't getting any colder inside the car than it was outside. And that night, the outside temperature never dipped below the middle 50s. Plus, there was more than enough oxygen inside the car to support him.
So, what killed him?
Fear?
Fear. In spite of all the seeming benefits available to the sight impaired, Dr. Strack feels that it is still that fear that holds people back, and sometimes it comes from the most well-meaning of sources. He commented, "Witness the attempts of organized education to hold blind people back for fear that they might not be able to handle the rigors of regular education." Or the fear of some educators who suggest that not every blind child needs to learn Braille because they don't want the child to look or feel different.
Worse, some educators feared that their power as educators might be threatened.
And what of the fear of parents so that they try to protect their children from all the bumps and bruises that sighted children use in order to grow and prosper? Maybe it is just possible that some of the fears that drive the protections might rub off. We might start actually believing and acting out those prejudices.
And the result is that a lot of us who are blind are made to feel that we are not as valuable as sighted persons, and some of us believe it.
So, what is the answer?
For Dr. Strax, the answer to that kind of fear is just to face it. To realize that the best antidote to fear is understanding, and the best source of understanding comes from association with those with a proven track record.
And who are the ones with the best proven track record?
We are the blind. When it comes to blindness, no one understands it better than we do. When it comes to overcoming blindness, no one does it better than we do. When it comes to setting an example for future generations, for achieving goals and dreams, no one creates an example better than we do. Blind people are not the cause of fear, but we endure the response to that fear. Our vision, our passion, ourselves, we are the cure. We must decide, once and for all, to make the fear factor go away.
You certainly sound like you agree with that perspective.
Yes, I do. And as an example, I'd like to refer to another doctor, in a manner of speaking, Doc Watson, the well-known local musician. He once commented that as a youth, his father told him that he might be blind, but he wasn't going to be worthless. He put him to work on one end of a crosscut saw. He made enough money cutting wood to buy a guitar.
Right. His father didn't protect him from life. He said, "This is it, and you're going to have to make your way." He tells of playing out in the fields with his sighted friends and says he was real good at finding while playing hide-and-seek. Common experiences kept away the fear.
One of my favorite stories about Doc Watson is when he was picking cherries, and his kid sister, who was also blind, came out and asked him to throw her down some cherries. He said if he did that, they'd get all dirty. So, he tied a rope around her waist and hoisted her up in the tree where she sat on a limb. Then he pulled a branch over for her to pick herself. Now, that's trust.
Anything else you want to add, Dr. Bill?
Yes. Personally, I don't like to be referred to as being a part of the blind community. The only community that I am a part of is the human community. Some people are good athletes. Some are not. Some are good with numbers. Some are not. Some understand computers. Some just barely get by. Some are sighted. Some are not. We all share common dreams and hopes, and all of us just wish for the same opportunities to fulfill them. I don't want anyone to treat me any differently than anyone else, or to be afraid to use the same language they would with anyone else. If I need help, I'll ask, and together, our different abilities shared just might be surprising.
You mean that sight-impaired people might be far better than someone might expect?
You bet.
Wow. You know something, Richard? Now, no disrespect to Bill, but I feel so much better with that answer coming from Dr. Bill.
If I could add one other item of interest, Mark Strax and Kristen Jokums met in 1999 at Federation for the Blind Conference in Chicago. They are now a couple with two children. In March of 2008, they purchased a bed and breakfast inn in Columbus, Georgia. Fear didn't keep them from operating the business, nor did it keep patrons from coming to that inn.
I'll bet Dr. Bill would agree with that, too.
It's time for another edition of the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with another episode of
Blind Justice
with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin. The setting is the Oakdale Stampede, held in the cowboy capital of the world, Oakdale, California. The scene opens with Bill sitting on the top of the chutes, looking down on the bucking bronco he is about to ride. Richard is up on the boards next to him.
Bill, you sure you ought to be doing this?
Too late to back out now. Why the change in mind?
Oh, I know what you can do, but I've been watching one rider after another get thrown and go bouncing off the ground. This is no picnic in the park, you know.
Why the worry all of a sudden? You were fine during the prelims.
Well, then I didn't know they were selling stock in an ambulance company. They've had three ambulances go out of here just this morning.
Settle down. I'll be just fine.
I just don't want you getting hurt, that's all.
Do you think I do? Richard, let me tell you a secret. A while back, I was feeling really bored. So I said to myself, you know what would be fun? I'll join a rodeo, ride a bucking bronco, get thrown for a loop, fall off, and break both legs. Then, while I'm lying there, the horse will kick me in the head. Not only will the horse give me brain damage, but he might also step on my hat. Now that would be a hoot.
Come on, Bill.
Better than that, I'll get Richard to come along and take pictures of me getting turned into sawdust in case I forget. Then he can be there to draw funny pictures on my cast. Whee! That would be a kick and a half in the pants.
Bill, what do you really expect to happen out there?
I expect to win.
You see what's been happening out there?
No.
Oh, darn it all. You know what I mean.
Richard, I know guys get thrown. I know guys get hurt. I've been bounced a few times myself. You just get up, dust yourself off, get back on and get better. I didn't come out here today to roll around in the dirt in front of a bunch of people. I came here to win.
You win what, cowboy? Shouldn't you be over in the kids section watching me? Oh, pardon me. You can't watch me. You can't even see your horse.
Hey.
Take it easy, Richard. He's just funning with us.
Tell me, partner. You practicing down at Kmart so you can tell which side of the horse to get on?
Cost me a few quarters, but I think I can tell the top from the bottom.
Well, you better be sure. You don't want your horse facing north, and you reach down and grab something going south.
All right, I've had it. Old Bill here can outride you any day of the week.
Oh, Bill, that sounds about right. Would he need his cane to get on?
You just come back after this event and see who's wearing the buckle.
Oh, won't have to wait that long. I'm up next. Now, just watch me. Oh, sorry, did it again. Okay, I'm set. Let's go.
Yeah! There he goes, and there he goes off. Two moves and that horse had him on the way to the ground. Mercy. And the way he hit, he's still trying to get up.
Cinch me in. Come on, I'm up next. Cinch me in. Okay, Richard, I'm ready.
Now, coming out of chute number 2 on Wildfire, Bill McClure.
Yeehaw!
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8! He did it! Riders are picking him up, and he's on the ground. And one of the rodeo clowns is leading him back, and they're running across the arena. Bill, you did it, just like you said.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Hey, cowboy, that was one mighty fine ride. I'd like to shake your hand, and I'd be privileged to buy you a beer.
And I'd be right proud to share one with you, if you didn't mind it being root beer.
Cowboy, if root beer can make you ride like that, I'm switching right now. Right this way, and if you don't mind, take my arm.
Another happy ending when there's...
Blind Justice.
Before we leave our visit with Doctors in Blindness, we're going to return for one more segment of the 2009 convention of the National Federation of the Blind that was sponsored in part by the National Association of Parents of Blind Children. One of the events was a special talk given to children by NFB President Dr. Mark Maurer. With Dr. Bill's help, we'd like to recreate part of his talk. He was introduced like this. We are going to present what has become a wonderful tradition at the seminar, the Kids Talk. Any children who would like an up-close and personal chat with Dr. Maurer, please come forward now and form a circle on the floor. We'd like to make Dr. Maurer sit down on the floor in his suit. Please welcome Dr. Maurer.
Oh, I'm supposed to sit down here? There I am. You didn't think I could get down that far. It's the getting up that's hard. I want to tell you something. My mother is here. And you know what she's doing? She's watching me. Now, I'm a blind person. Shall we start with that? When I was your age, that was a long time ago, I didn't know I was a blind person. I found out sort of gradually. I remember the day I really found out. I found out because I was out in my front yard, and I went into the house, and my brother, who was sighted, said, "There's Dad driving by." And then he said something about the street that was half a block away. I had no idea that people could see that far. I remember people would say, "Did you see that?" And, "Would you look at that?" I'd always try, but I could never make it. Then one time they took me to a doctor. They said I was going to be tested. They put a big image on some kind of screen that had a light. I could tell that there was a light, but I couldn't tell what the image was. The doctor said to my mother, "Does he know what that is?" She said, "Yes, he knows." But I couldn't see it. I tried, but I failed. And I thought, "This is a bad thing. I'm not supposed to fail the test. I'm supposed to pass the test." If they had said they were going to measure my vision instead of testing it, that would have been better. I was failing, and I hated that. When I found out I was blind, it was sadness for me. I learned that some people thought it was bad to be blind. And sometimes when they said it, it sounded like I was bad because I was blind. It wasn't my fault. I hadn't done it on purpose. But later on, I found out that it's not bad to be blind. It's just something that happens to some people. One time I came here and said it was all right to be lost. I've been lost lots of times. I get found again. It's not a bad thing to be lost. As a matter of fact, you meet some new people that way. Usually. And you find out some new things. I've been blind all my life. And it's still lots of fun to go and do exciting things. And it doesn't matter if you're blind. That's what I've learned. Now, I talked to the hotel yesterday, and I told them you were going to be here. And I also told them that you were going to carry your canes. I've got my cane. The reason it's fun to carry a cane is that when you walk around, the cane runs into stuff before you do. It doesn't hurt the cane, but if you bump into something with your nose, it will hurt your nose. I know this because I did it before. Now, I'm going to stand up here. Let's see if I can get this done.
Do you know something else that happens at the National Federation of the Blind conventions? They give out Jacob Bulletin Awards for outstanding work with the blind. Gary Wunder, secretary for the Federation, opened the presentations with this comment.
As blind people, what words do we most often hear when we enter a room? "Here's a chair. Sit right here." No matter how smart and adventurous we are, People are most comfortable when we are stationary.
The first award that day went to an organization dedicated to the idea that blind people don't belong in chairs. It went to Camp Tashmahita in Michigan.
Now, that's a funny name. What does it mean?
It's named for the four senses you have when you're blind: touch, smell, hearing, and taste. The camp was started in 1972 by the Michigan School for the Blind, and thousands of kids have gone there to learn the skills of the blind.
Now, that's a great idea. Don't you think so, Dr. Bill?
Yes, I do. And I think Bill would agree also.
Well, I don't think he knows much about camps in Michigan. But I do have a question about cowboys.
Go ahead.
Well, earlier we had the story of Bill as a rodeo rider. Is that possible?
Why not? It doesn't take eyesight to get on a horse. And after that, the horse will take you where you want to go. And the horse won't run into other horses like cars will do.
Well, I know, but what about a cowboy with ropes and guns and things?
I hope this will satisfy you. I have a story about a cowboy named Blind Bill.
Oh, come on. Is this like Dr. Bill and Professor Bill?
No, I know who he means. Blind Bill Houlihan. And it all happened up in Meteetse, Wyoming, in the early 1890s.
Right.
Oh, I do remember this. He had a partner named Bill Gallagher, who was a mean, vicious sort of guy. Now, Gallagher had this girlfriend.
The girl's name was...
Belle Drury, yeah. And after a few years with Bill Gallagher, Belle took a liking to Bill Wheaton.
Boy, there sure were a lot of Bills in this story.
Probably one too many.
And when Bill Gallagher found out about Bill Wheaton, he got a hold of Belle and beat her up right in the middle of town.
And Belle?
Well, Belle wasn't too happy with this, so she borrowed a gun and gave it to Bill Wheaton, who shot Bill Gallagher.
But that's not the end of the story.
Now Blind Bill gets involved.
Was Blind Bill totally blind?
Probably not.
Well, he's pictured with a patch over his left eye, so he's at least blind in one eye.
And can't see out of the other?
But he could see good enough to strap on his gun and come after Bill Wheaton.
But not good enough to shoot him. Bill Wheaton killed old Blind Bill.
Got sent to prison for it.
Left Belle all alone.
Not for long. She was a lonely girl.
Mighty lonely.
Took up with a fellow named John Corbett.
It sure wasn't Bill Corbett.
Don't think so. Anyway, we got enough Bills.
Yeah. Bills of all denominations.
Anyway, John Corbett had a feud going on with one Jesse Conway.
One night he up and shot old Jesse.
But the next night, some of Jesse's friends came back to town and killed poor old Belle and three other women.
Not lonely anymore.
Affected the whole town.
Yep. After that, the whole town of Arlen just sort of dried up.
Arlen was the early name for Meteetse.
Town could survive without Bill Gallagher, Blind Bill, Bill Wheaton, John Corbett, Jesse Conway.
Couldn't survive without Belle and the other ladies.
Even moved the gravesites down the road a piece.
Yep. Belle Drury, Bill Gallagher, and Blind Bill Houlihan are now permanent residents of Old Trail Town, 32 miles away in Cody.
Well, that answers that question. Thank you, Dr. Bill.
Feel better?
Better than what?
Anything else?
Yeah. Oh, Dr. Bill, what's the proper way to help a blind person get on a horse?
Bob, did you have a horse?
No.
Then why not start with a car?
That's a good idea. Dr. Bill, I was giving a friend a ride home a while ago, and I'm not sure I got it right. I opened the car door for my friend, and then I reached in to buckle him in. This wasn't received very well. Is there a proper way to do this?
First of all, you can see the car door. He can't. To you, it's open. To him, it's right smack in the middle of his face. Just guide him up to the car, and then let him open and close the door for himself. Secondly, don't assume your friend is helpless. He knows where the seat belt is. He can fasten his own seat belt. A sight-impaired person may need assistance locating your car, but after that, treat him just the way you would treat any sighted person.
Got it. But what if I did get a horse?
Is it equipped with seat belts?
Well, the one I ride at the mall is, but it doesn't have room for a rider.
No?
It's a small animal, just a one-horse engine.
A think if you can help a sight-impaired person to find the mall, they'll be able to locate the horse on their own.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. We have two volunteers with us now, John Livers and Tim Farrington. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
Welcome to our show today, and one of the things that we're trying to accomplish here is to give our readers an opportunity to get to know the people who are reading to them. So, John, we'll start with you and give us a little bit of background about yourself and about your interests, and specifically what got you interested in Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Well, I'm currently retired. We lived in North Carolina. We moved here in 86 and then moved away in 89 and moved back in 2003. And when we were here before, my children graduated from school here, and one daughter went to the University of North Carolina. My son went to Wesleyan, and they stayed. We went away to Texas, and my son ended up marrying a girl who had gone to the University of North Carolina as well. So this is where the grandchildren were. So on the second retirement, Sheila Must Be Obeyed, my wife, said, we're going back to North Carolina. So that's why we're here. And she volunteers with hospice, and I volunteered with the Orange County Literacy Council. I sit on their board of directors, and I teach English as a second language as another volunteer with the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. And one of the things that came up in my discussion with the RSVP people was that they were looking for volunteers for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And I said, oh, that's kind of interesting, because a friend of mine used to read for that service in New York. And I said, well, I'm not doing anything. I'll go over and see if I could pass the test. And so I sat down with Linda, and she said, yeah, we think we could use you. So that's the story.
So, Tim, let's talk with you for a while.
Yes, sir.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your involvement with the organization.
I've lived in North Carolina all my life, born here in 1971, never moved away except for a short stint at UNC Greensboro, but came back here. It's where the family is. It's where I want to be. I have been with the Triangle Radio Reading Service longer than I can recall, to be honest. I believe I started in the late 90s, because I'm fairly certain I was doing this at the turn of the millennium. So it's been a while. Read on Wednesday nights, moved to Tuesday nights, did a little recording, but just love coming out. It's a lot of fun.
What types of programs have you both read for the reading service? Have you stuck with mostly live reads, or have you also done some recording?
I primarily have done the live reads. I've done the a couple of morning shows with the News and Observer, that sort of thing, where we've done the local newspapers. Really do kind of like doing the USA Today, though, in the evening. It works out better for me. I live in Chapel Hill, and so it's easy to come over and do that. I find that a whole lot more efficient, just to be able to come over and cut the paper, plan the program, and put it together. It usually works quite well for me.
I've done mostly live reads, too. Back when you used to do the Durham Herald Sun, we read that for years and years, and then moving over to the USA Today, so now we do that. I've only done a little recording. Since I'm a teacher and have summers off, I was able to come in a couple of summers and record some short stories and some poems, I think.
Where do you teach, Tim?
I teach English, I think sixth grade, sort of 10, 11-year-olds up at Wakefield Middle School.
Oh, yes. A challenging age.
They are. They promised me it was a ticket to heaven, so that's why I'm in.
Now, John, what type of work are you retired from?
Well, I was in insurance. Last job I had, I was the CEO of the North Dakota Farm Bureau and Mutual Insurance Company. And before that, I was executive vice president of the Gulf Group, seven companies down in Texas. And then we acquired for America, and then we bought Travelers Insurance Company. And I retired the first time as executive vice president of the Travelers Holding Company, played for a while, and then got bored and wound up going up to North Dakota to do a turnaround on that company up there. And then retired again in 2003 and moved back down here.
Think you're going to stick with your present occupation?
Well, my present occupation is running around with grandkids, mowing the lawn, teaching the English as a second language, which I enjoy. Doing this, I enjoy this as well. Mm-hmm. And if I can find the time, one of the things I would like to do is I would like to do some recording of either poetry or novels. I like mysteries as well. And the only other thing I do is a hobby is I barbecue. My daughter-in-law, where she's gone into the barbecue business. I'm the barbecuer. She's the peddler. So
good. Great. Since you've been reading for the reading service, what changes would you like, or what response would you like from our listeners as concerning your program?
Well, I think that the one thing I'm always concerned about is you do the reading, and you always wonder, well, did I really do a good job? Am I doing it well enough? I mean, it's kind of a little feedback, a little bit of constructive input from time to time from people. I think that would be the thing that I miss most, just some kind of a grading system sometime that says, you know, you're doing all right, or you're not doing all right, or you need to do this, or you're going too fast, or whatever.
Certainly wouldn't hurt my feelings if listeners could tell us specifically, hey, Tuesday night, guys, you talk too fast,
right,
or, you know, I think you're mispronouncing some names, or, you know, some compliments would always be great as well.
Oh, sure.
Now, I want to ask you one more question before we sign off.
Yes, sir.
Had either of you known any blind people before you started reading, or have you gotten to know any since you've started reading?
You know, John and I were talking about this before we went on the air, and I think my answer is probably going to be no. If I had, it only would have been perhaps through a relationship of my grandmother's, perhaps someone either when she was still living up in Wake Forest or in a retirement community, but that's about the only thing I could think of at the time.
Okay.
How about you, John?
Well, I've actually known some visually impaired people. As I say, I had a friend of mine in New York who actually read for the radio station in New York. But since actually I've been doing this, I really haven't had much exposure or opportunity to meet very many visually impaired people here. I mean, I see you around from time to time, and I see a few at the picnics and stuff that we do once a year. But right now with what I'm involved in, I really don't have any that I'm exposed to around the Chapel Hill area.
Well, certainly wonderful to be able to visit with both of you today, and I appreciate what you're doing for Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Thanks for letting us come in and chat with you today.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin, and another edition of
Blind Justice.
As the scene opens, we find Bill shopping at the department store. He's at the customer service desk.
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
Can you direct me to the skis?
Skis are in the sporting goods department. Just follow the blue line on the floor. Next.
Blue line on the floor.
Sir, the blue line. You're standing on the green line. The green line goes to lingerie, and I'm sure that's not what you'd be wearing on the ski slopes. Just a little department store humor.
Thanks for the help. Just let me take your arm.
The aisles are a little crowded here. Why don't you just follow me? Around the boxes and look out for the shopping cart. Here we are, sporting goods. The skis are right over there on the far wall. What? Where did he go? Didn't even have the courtesy to tell me.
Attention shoppers, our next ring-a-ding special is in the sporting goods department. The first 10 customers at the ring-a-ding in sporting goods will receive 50% off digital depth finders. Just the thing for the avid fisherman.
Congratulations, sir. You are a lucky customer. Would you like our standard depth finder or the special deluxe ring-a-ding depth finder, which features an LED readout at either feet or metric?
No, thank you. I'm looking for skis.
Come on, sir. You look like a fishing man to me. How are you going to get the big ones without a digital depth finder?
I don't find them. If I want to go fishing, I just throw out a line and the fish find me.
Just throw out a line? How primitive. Then, how about a new rod and reel? Everyone will notice you if you're casting with one of these.
When I go fishing, I just sit on the bank in the shade of a tree and relax. Just tie a piece of string around my cane, and it works just fine.
That keen? Sir, just between you and me, I don't think bass are attracted to red and white.
Skis, please.
Sir, they're right over there.
Welcome to our next ring-a-ding-ding customer. Yes, sir, may I assist you?
Please, I'm interested in some skis.
Well, sir, you're standing right next to them. I am very sorry. I didn't notice. I'm an assistant manager, and I'll get a clerk immediately. Richard, over here, please, and assist this gentleman.
Yes, sir. You again. Well, if you're interested in the digital depth finder, the ring-a-ding has stopped ringing.
I don't want to be a bother, and I know I must be standing close to them, but I'm interested in some skis for a beginner.
Good for you, sir, and at your age. Just take a look at these. They'd be perfect for the beginner of any age.
Thank you, but...
And as any skier knows, his skis are only as good as his ski boots. Let me pick some out for you.
That's all right.
No trouble at all, sir. I'll be right back.
Attention shoppers, we have another ring-a-ding special in footwear. The next 5 customers to the ring-a-ding in the shoe department will get not only 50% off ski boots, but a free DVD of local ski resorts.
Sir, are you lucky? You don't have to go to the ring-a-ding. The ring-a-ding is coming to you. Sort of like Moses in the Mountain. That's a little department store humor. What size were you looking for?
About a 7B.
Pardon me for noticing this, sir, but I don't think you can fit into a size 7.
They're not for me. They're a birthday present for my granddaughter.
Then you are a lucky customer. 7B is what I happen to be carrying. That's an additional 5% off. And just look how these boots go with the skis you've selected. Made for each other, sir. You have quite an eye. Shall I ring them up?
Well...
Did I mention that we have a ring-a-ding special on skis? Any purchase made today will give you a free weekend lift ticket at the resort of your choice.
How can you pass that up?
How indeed. Here's your receipt, sir. You can pick up everything at the will call. Just follow the yellow line on the floor. Thank you again, sir, and remember us every time you hear this.
Attention shoppers, it's time for another ring-a-ding special. The first 5 customers at will call, when the ring-a-ding sounds, will receive free carry-out to the parking lot.
Well, sir, aren't you the lucky one today? Let's get you over to will call and out to your car so you can be on your way. Where are you parked, sir?
In the blue zone.
The blue zone, sir? That's reserved for the handicapped.
I know.
Well, since you're such a valued customer, we'll let it pass this time. Sort of turn a blind eye, so to speak. That's a little department store humor. But in the future, and again, thank you, and don't forget your DVD.
All finished shopping, Bill?
Yes, and thanks for the ride. I appreciate it.
Any problems?
No more than usual. Anyway, the smile on my granddaughter's face when she gets these for her birthday will make up for any problems.
Wish you could see that smile, Bill.
Oh, but I can. I can. Let's go.
And this ends another case of
Blind Justice.
And now from Myra DeBruhl, a poem from one Governor Moorhead graduate to another.
This is a poem that I wrote a while back, and it's dedicated to Ronnie Millsap. It's real. It really did happen, and I hope that some of you can identify with it. It's called Stardust. Come on, let's go hear him, the one that you said you knew. And I wondered if I went because I really wanted to. But then your music drew the curtain up from all the past, and memories stood there opened for the world to hear at last. You were getting started then on your climb up the ladder, higher, higher, out of reach, as though it didn't matter. Come on, let's go hear him sing. Tonight he's coming home. But nobody could go with me, so I went alone. and in my mind I took the words my heart had learned to say. How proud I was that it was you, a special star today. But as I reached the building, I heard excited roars of disappointed voices, and policemen barred the doors. I ran into that noisy crowd, and I pushed my way on through, and in my hand I held a photograph of me with you. Don't you see? I know him. I showed it to the guard, but he just had a job to do, and I just made it hard. Then, like me, your picture somehow got lost in all the crowd. But just as though you heard them, I said the words out loud. The curtain fell on yesterday, but I knew I would be content with having known you when all your songs were free.
Do we have time for an outside the box?
Just what I had in mind. It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. We are in a classroom and we hear this assignment. Everyone likes to see patterns. It's organization. So if you know the pattern, you'll know what will happen next. Here's a group of letters. Find the pattern so you can tell me what letter comes next. O, T, T, F, F, S, S, E, N. What's the next letter?
Well, maybe the letters stand for the first letter of maybe the words of a phrase.
Such as?
Well, I don't know, like maybe, an emergency call. Officers to the first fire plug south of the second entrance next to,
Next to what?
It doesn't work, does it?
It only works if the phrase is one that is very well known.
Well, how about a list of things, like maybe, occupations, maybe? Operator? Teacher? Trainer? Yes! Fireman, furrier, senator, secretary, engineer, and what's next? Nature guide. The next letter is a G.
What if the person is in the National Guard? Or a nurse in the garden?
Well, the letter is still G.
Bob, the indication still has to be familiar to everyone.
Oh, so what words are familiar that the letters could stand for?
What if they are not words? What if they're numbers? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10!
T! 10! The next letter is T!
Another solution, thanks to creative thinking from... Outside the Box.
Ooh. I wish Dr. Bill was still here.
We're almost at the end of the program, Bob. Why do you wish he was still here?
Well, I had another question for him.
Let's see if this will help. What's on your mind?
Wow, that did help. A little. Well, anyway, I have a friend who heard about our program where we can provide subchannel receivers to people who are sight impaired. If someone wanted to request such a receiver, how would he go about doing it? Is it difficult?
We have an expert in that area also, May Tran. May, if someone wants a sub-channel receiver, how do they get one?
All they have to do is just call me. I normally answer the phone and write their name down, and as soon as we have one available, we'll send them one.
May, thank you for that information. I'll be sure to tell my friend. You know something, Bill? You know almost as much as Dr. Bill. Oh, before you go, I have one more question.
Bob, you said you only had one question.
Well, this is it.
Go ahead.
We always start and end our programs with a statement. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Why do we do that?
You're in luck, Bob. Linda is here, and we'll let her answer that for you.
We specifically use this little verbiage. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. so that we feel that we are not violating copyright for material that we are reading directly from the print copy, because we broadcast on more than a closed circuit of our radio system. We need to be certain that people are aware that we read our material with the intent of assisting people who cannot read it in the format in which it currently exists, i.e., in standard print. Whether they are visually impaired, whether they are blind, whether they can no longer hold print material, or even if they can no longer comprehend print material because they've had a stroke or some sort of a brain trauma. We want to make certain that the people who listen to us via television and the internet understand that this information is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
Did that answer the question for you?
Yes, and just in time.
This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
Thank you. And in closing, this thought from William Faulkner from his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. It is easy enough to say that a man is immortal just because he will endure. That when the last ding-dong of doom has clanged and faded from the last worthless rock hanging tideless in the last red and dying evening, that even then there will still be one more sound, that of his puny, inexhaustible voice still talking. I refuse to accept this. I believe that man will not only endure, he will prevail. He is immortal not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance.
This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for listening to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan, and not only is this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience, it is designed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. I think I'll take Bill down to the mall and see if he can find the horse.
We'd like comments about this program. Please call us at 919-832-5138.
Or if you could help underwrite this or any of our programs, your financial assistance would be deeply appreciated.
You know, on second thought, I think I'll skip the horse and send my quarter to TRRS.
Bob, is Bill only worth one quarter?
Oh, no. Oh, I'll go home and get some more quarters.
Good idea, Bob. Take my arm, and we'll go together.
Goodbye.